my voice, but during the worship time, I felt like I was caught up in hearing the voices of heaven all around the throne, singing God's praise. It was kind of I couldn't sing, but I felt very much a part of something very special as we were singing together. So thank you, choir. Thank you, worship team. Overwhelmed. I love weddings. Not all pastors do. I have a friend who loves funerals. He just loves going to funerals. He loves doing funerals as a pastor. I really don't. I really enjoy weddings. And there's this part in when I'm leading in a wedding that I'm always watching for, and it's kind of that really unique moment for me. And it's not when the couple maybe says their vows to one another. Sometimes it's really special when you've got couples write some of their own vows, and all of a sudden that it comes together and they have that moment to look in each other's eyes and say those vows. It's not that moment. It's not the moment when they actually kiss. I mean, that is a special moment for me because our pastor forgot to tell us to kiss in our wedding. So every time I always make sure I remind the couple that they can kiss, but we forgot to do that. So we've been making up for it all after that. That's why we're both sick now, because we've been kissing too much, going back and forth. But you know, the part for me that is just I always watch for it, and I just love it when it happens. It's when that groom, if he hasn't seen his bride before, and all of a sudden he catches her beauty and her splendor, and it's just it's an amazing moment that happens if you can see it. And I'm oftentimes watching not the bride come in, but him, to see what happens. And all sorts of things happen. Some of them are just right over the top, right? They just are speechless, and they're just almost they're wired with it. Others kind of hide their eyes and close their eyes, and almost as if I'm sure what goes on inside. I actually don't deserve her. I don't deserve her, God. You know, like they're just like caught with that kind of a whoa type of an experience. Others, you know, if you're ever going to see a guy cry, it's this type of thing. That's what you watch, and the tears come, and they got to pull it together. And then others, you know, like we're told men don't cry, so they try to be real stoic about it, right? And it creates their own kind of goofy kind of looks type of thing. It looks like this guy's been sucking lemons all morning long, right? And really, he's just overcome by the emotions. That song that we just sang has really kind of the reverse kind of effect, and it's really not so much the groom seeing the bride, but it's really the opposite. That Big Daddy Weeb, who wrote that song, and we were the bride of Christ, and really it's, he's kind of reflecting on how he feels overwhelmed when he sees the groom, when he really captures the majesty of who God is. And, you know, this song was crafted, I mean, they had just developed their song called Redeemed, which really is about the saving blood of Christ. And it was just after they had actually done that song that Big Daddy Weeb, the lead singer there, was in his garage where a lot of their stuff actually is produced. And then he was there, and the chorus came to him, and it was going, and he couldn't quite pull it together beyond that. But the chorus was there, and then the name Phil Wickman kept coming to him. And he didn't know Phil before that. I mean, he knew Phil wrote other worship stuff. And so out of the blue, he texted or emailed Phil, and they started dialoguing back and forth. And then Phil Wickman, who has wrote other worship stuff, they collaborated, and he gave them some verses to go with the song, and all of a sudden it just came together, and Big Daddy Weeb as a band were going on a short-term missions trip with World Vision to Tanzania, and so they were on their way, and they had still just been working on the song, and when they got there on that World Vision trip, they were overcome by the people in such an amazing way that they actually recorded. And if you listen to the actual recording of this song by Big Daddy Weeb, you'll hear children singing. Those are children in Tanzania, as they actually caught these kids, and they were overwhelmed by a sense of God's presence, and they recorded them on site there. And every time they perform that song, they bring those voices in as a sense of a reminder of how much they were overwhelmed by the glory and the majesty of God. And so I see the work of his hands. The galaxies spin in a heavenly dance. Oh God, all that you are is so overwhelming. I hear the sound of your voice. You know, they were hearing the sound of his voice in these little children. All at once, it's gentle and thundering noise. Oh delight myself in you, captivated by your beauty. I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed by you. You know, on Thanksgiving Sunday, oftentimes we'll take a few moments to hear a few words of testimony, and we're not going to do that this morning. We're going to do something different. I'm going to ask you to get into triads. Now, a triad is more than one. It's two, but it's not more than four. And I want you to turn around to just a few of the people around you, a triad of two to four, and I want you just to take 30 seconds, 40 seconds, to share a moment maybe or something that you're deeply overwhelmed with gratitude to God about, thankfulness. So just do that right now. I'm going to give you 4 minutes to do that, and then we're going to come back. So just turn to the people around you, huddle in, make some triads happen, and just why don't you give a testimony to God's gracefulness, thankfulness, fullness in your life. So you might have to move a step or two. You got the next 4 minutes together. Thirty more seconds. Okay, hopefully you can carry on that conversations a little bit. Sort of a question that I wanted you to ponder. It was on the front of the handout sheet when you came in, which are sermon notes. And if you want to take those sermon notes, we're going to have a chance to kind of look at that. We're actually jumping into the Gospel of John here. Last week we sort of started, we said that this would be part of kind of the place where we're going to anchor ourselves for the year in our Sunday morning services. And we gave out last week, or a couple of weeks ago, a reading plan. And so some of you have picked that up, and you should be partway through John already. In 10 weeks, you can just read through the whole John and have a chance to us reflect on some questions. And we'd love you to kind of immerse yourself in your devotional reading in John for a little bit, so that when we come together, some of what we talk about might not be too foreign. You've got a little bit of an awareness. And we've been doing it in a thematic way. We're going to go through John more, not in a chronological from start to finish, but more thematically around these four major areas of what we believe a disciple needs to work on or be involved with or grow in, these areas that are very key to the health of our relationship as followers of Jesus Christ. So these four items, and today is the second Sunday of the month, which is our Grow Sunday, which we really want to have this element of interactive piece, so you just spend a little bit of time talking to your neighbor, and we're going to be bringing that into service every time we come together. So let's just jump right in. I want to give you today more of an overview of the book of John, but also John himself as an author, so that when we get into the text, we'll have a bigger picture, but also know the heart, maybe, of the man who wrote this book. So take that sheet. You can fill in the blanks. There's some blanks that you can fill in as we go along. So what do we know about John himself, the author? This is an iconic painting of him. We know a number of things about John. The gospel itself does not actually name John in it as the author. Some of Paul's letters actually do. John doesn't. But from church history and most scholars, really don't debate the fact that John, this disciple of Christ, is the writer of this gospel. So what are the things that we know about him? Well, there's a number of things that we know. We know he was John was the son of Zebedee, that James was his brother, and they are called by Jesus from fishing to actually being his followers. So their career, their background was fishing, which wasn't a high intellectual position. I mean, he doesn't have this pedigree of schooling and background. He was a fisherman who caught a glimpse of who Jesus Christ was. And he goes on to be one of the first followers, that first group of followers of Jesus, and then actually goes on to become actually one of the inner three. You oftentimes read about Peter, James, and John, these three disciples that seem to be kind of an inner group that Jesus really opens up his heart to at times. And Paul actually, or John refers to himself in the gospel as the disciple Jesus loved. And we were talking about this actually before, that, you know, this is one of the things about John. I mean, did Jesus only love John? No. No, Jesus loved all of his disciples. But John deeply is impacted by the fact that Jesus loves him. And he maybe a bit of a sensitive kind of a spirit or a nature that he could just take it all in. And so he actually becomes one of the early witnesses to the resurrection. Him and Peter run to the tomb. They're the first ones in. Actually, John is the very first one that sees the grave close, and he's kind of contemplating that when then Peter comes in. Or no, he's standing outside watching, and he doesn't go in. Peter's the very first one to go in, and then John comes in. But it does say that John believed. He's one of the very first ones that sees the empty grave close and really actually believes, actually encounters the sense that the resurrection has taken. And we read about him later, the fact that he's a pillar of the church. Paul, after he gets converted and he's preaching the gospel, he goes to Jerusalem to try to, you know, kind of, am I on the right track here? And he talks about three individuals, Peter, James, and John, who are the pillars of the church. And he submits himself to them. So John, you know, from this very start of being one of these inner core of the disciples, he went on along with Peter and James, his brother, or it may be the other James, we're not quite sure which one. Really the pillars, the foundation, the key leaders of the church in Jerusalem. And then later in life, we read about John being exiled onto the island of Patmos. The last letter he writes, Revelation, which he does name himself in, he talks about him being in exile on this island of Patmos. And I'll show you where that is in just a moment. And then he goes on, and he actually is understood to be the author of three different, or five different documents, three different groupings, the one gospel, the Gospel of John, and then three letters, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. That's all 1, 2, 3 means. It's first letter, second letter, third letter. And they're written to different people, and they're not even in order, just numbering the letters to keep them separate. And then this Revelation piece at the very end. And uniquely, we'll talk about dating of those documents in just a moment. So this is who John is. John is, and he's
pictured, if you can see here in this picture of him, he's drawn as almost looking very young alongside Jesus. And John seems to have been, from tradition, as best we know, the longest living disciple. And so there really is a sense that he might have been one of the youngest ones too. And so oftentimes in the pictures of him, he looks very young compared to other disciples, because there's a really good understanding that probably he was one of the youngest disciples. With James and John, it's always James first. The older would always go first, James and John. So he was obviously the younger, but there's that sense that he lived the longest, probably was the youngest of the crew, type of thing. And uniquely, he writes last. And so let's talk about that, really, the date of the gospel. Here's a picture of present-day Turkey, and present-day Turkey is kind of in the news these days because of what's happening with the clash across the border into Syria and the Kurdish people. I prayed about that. It bothers me. And we've been traveled there. It's kind of a unique country. If you ever have a chance to go to Istanbul, Nancy and I, when we went there, it was just an amazing place to go. And there's so much culture, and we really just enjoyed our time there. But we read about John, down in let me see if I can get this pointer going. There we go. Down in Jerusalem here, where he is the leader of the church. That's where we first find him. He's kind of after the resurrection. He's leading the church, and then we actually read in the Gospels about John actually going north up here to Antioch, where the gospel goes outside the Jewish circles, and him and John, Peter and John, go up as heads of the church to check on what's happening there as the gospel is going out beyond the Jewish borders. And so we read about that. And then, like I said, we read about him. Oops, sorry guys. Let me just see if I can get that back here. I pushed the wrong button. And I can't quickly get there from here. Here we go. The island of Patmos is right there. So we do know that he ends up on Patmos, where he has his vision. And then he writes to those churches. You can see in a semicircle here, right here, there's the four churches, or seven churches, I should say, in the book of Revelation. They're in a bit of a traveling route, a semicircle. And so he writes those letters. The issue that we wrestle with is a little bit, when was the gospel written? When were the letters written? When was Revelation written? We don't, it's hard to get those details really together, but early tradition, like we're talking just the generations after John's death and others, the ones that wrote, church leaders at that time, would say that he wrote somewhere in the 90s to the 100s, right in that last decade of that century. And that would make his writings, his five writings, the last five writings of the New Testament. So Revelation, it comes to the very end. It doesn't mean it's the last thing that was written. There is a very good possibility that, because an early church father says that John has his vision on Patmos, but then returns back to Ephesus. He gets back from exile and lives out his days in Ephesus. And it's there that he actually then writes his gospel and his letters from. So we're not quite sure which document of his five comes first. Is it the gospel? Is it the revelation? But these are written very at the very end, and they're later than everything else. Paul's writings are in the 60s, 70s. Other gospels are kind of in that age. The earliest writing that we have is probably in the 45 to 50, sort of a decade after Christ's death, is the earliest kind of sense of writings. And do you know what the earliest writing in the New Testament is? James? It might be James, or it might be also Galatians. There's a kind of a debate between which one is kind of the earliest kind of a document. So those are the early kind of things. So we're going to move on here, and let's talk about, you got a little handle here, about the uniqueness of John's gospel. It is a very unique gospel. And I want to try to help us understand a little bit about it as we get into it. There's a few things that you're going to see. One is that sometimes you've heard about the word synoptic, which really just means simply seeing the same or seeing together. So that's what that word means. And what it has to do with is how we see Mark. Mark is probably the first gospel that was written. And Mark was written probably in the 50s, okay, by Mark. But gospels had to be had apostolic authority. so the best that we understand is that Mark traveled with Peter, and Peter actually is telling and preaching the gospel, and then actually is a key part of forming the gospel of Mark. Although Mark was the one that penned it, it really is a collection of Peter's story, and it's the earliest kind of gospel, because obviously Peter was recognized as a very key leader in the church. But a decade or so later, you have Matthew and Luke, who take the gospel of Mark. We're pretty sure that both of them have the gospel of Mark, and they use it because there are actually passages in Mark and Matthew and Luke that are identical to what's in Mark. And then there's other changes, and so there's also this, John is down there, we'll come to him, but there's this other document called Q that they're pretty sure that both Matthew and Luke have another document that they're both referencing somehow, or that maybe Matthew is a little bit before Luke, and that Luke has reference to both Mark and Matthew, and so he picks up some of Matthew. But there's some sense that the earliest gospel we have is Mark. It's a very quick, fast-moving gospel. And then out of that, a decade or so later, in the 60s, 70s, both Matthew and Luke write their gospel. And they write their gospel very specifically to certain groups of people. Matthew is written to Jews. You can put right beside that Jews. It's written specifically to Jews, and over again, he tries to show by quoting scriptures that Jesus fulfills the Old Testament prophecies of the Messiah. That's a real part of what Matthew is trying to do to a Jewish audience. Whereas Luke, who traveled with Paul, you know, around the Gentile world, is really writing to a Gentile audience. He actually names one Gentile person in his gospel that he's writing to, and he's writing to Gentiles to help them understand that Jesus is the Son of God. So they have a little difference. So these three are very similar together, but John, it's just, there's no reference point. He's not on the same page. His gospel is very different than the other three. So oftentimes when you hear the phrase synoptic gospels, it refers to those three that see together very much the story, the order of the events, whereas John is very different. The reason that that's very different, I'm trying to get caught up here with my, is that John is, let me go back one here. Let's just go to that one and come back to it. One of the realities is that John, 40% of the gospel is about the last week of Jesus' life. So as he tells his story, he really focuses on the last week of Jesus' life. Actually, a third of the gospel, the third of the whole gospel of John is about the last 12 hours of Jesus' life, his passion. That's a very in a unique way. John is encapsulated by that and goes in it. Here's a bit of a little bar graph that you can see in front of you that gives you an idea of how the actual passage fits. There's a beginning, there's an end, and then there's two middles. There's two middle sections, and the breakdowns of that is chapter 1 is kind of the beginning part of it, and then chapter 2 to 11 is the first middle, and then 12 to 20 is the second middle, and then the last one is an epilogue or the end. And what scholars have recognized that the first one is kind of the book of signs. All the miracles that are in John are in the first little bit. And then he spends the last one talking about God's glorification of Jesus through his death, burial, and resurrection, and the authenticity of who he is in all his glory. So that's kind of a way that oftentimes they will break down the actual book. So one of the things as we go into this is to understand that John tells a very unique story. And it's important for us to understand it's not a chronological story. Okay? Oftentimes when we tell a story, we start from beginning to end. And as John tells his gospel, you have to take yourself off of that, because he's not telling a chronological story. It's a story that has a lot of symbolism in it. And I'm going to demonstrate to you how he puts his gospel together. The reality is that Luke actually wants his gospel to be very much a chronological movement through the life of Jesus. And so he actually says right up front, this is what I'm doing. I'm re- searching, I'm getting witnesses, I'm looking at all this stuff, and I'm trying to give you an orderly account of everything. And so we really think that, you know, Mark and Luke are probably the best kind of chronology of the events as they unfolded. But both Matthew and John switch it up a little bit sometimes. Matthew follows pretty much, but John is very, very different because it's not about chronology for him. It's about the symbols that he's trying to bring across to us in the actual story. And one of those is an example of that would be, you know, chapter one. Chapter one is set up in such a way that there's this symbolic identification with Genesis chapter one. The first three words of John chapter one is in the beginning, right? And what are the first three words? In the beginning. There's very much a tie, and in a lot of different ways, even later on, he's writing, remember, at the very end of all the writings, and this is a time when the Church of Jesus Christ is coming into its own, and it really is trying to identify itself coming out of Judaism, but different from Judaism. And so in even that first chapter, he makes a very clear statement right from the very beginning that the law, you know, that which starts with Genesis, was given through Moses. But God's unfailing love and faithfulness, as he's contrasting the two, is coming to us through Jesus Christ. So there's a very definite symbolism in the way the first chapter of John is set up when it's compared to potentially how the Torah is set up in Genesis chapter 1. Also, there is the symbolism of these seven I am statements. What are some of the I ams? I am the way, the truth, the life. What's six? No. Bread. I think six is bread. I'm the bread of life. John chapter 8, light of the world. John 10, two of them in there. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. So these symbolisms. I am the resurrection, the life. That's where he raises Lazarus. That's the end of the signs kind of book. I am the way, the truth, and the life, upper room with his disciples. And then chapter 15, I am the vine. These are very much, John takes the teachings of Jesus, wraps them around these I am statements, lets Jesus, through his own words, reveal to us the fullness of who he is. And so it's important. We're not going to spend any more time here because as we go through the next several months, we're going to be working through these I am statements and finding the significance of them. But it's interesting that he picks seven of them and he puts them out there in his gospel. We're going to talk about why in just a moment here. And then there's the symbolism of seven miraculous signs. Jesus did lots of things. But it's interesting that John picks seven miraculous signs, sometimes not even recorded in the other Gospels, and places them as the only seven things in the Gospel that he actually tells the story about. And these seven things are chapter 2, the turning of the water into wine. And actually, as he records this, he actually talks about it. He actually makes the statement, this miraculous sign at Cana of Galilee was the first time Jesus showed his glory to his disciples and his disciples believed. So he actually starts counting. This is one. And then when you get into chapter 4, there's the healing of the official's son. And he actually counts again. He said, this was the second miraculous sign. So he's setting us up already to start counting. He doesn't continue with the counting as he moves on. But he then tells us about these other signs that come up in these different chapters, and there are seven of them altogether. And then at the end of chapter 11, there's no more talk of miraculous signs, things that Jesus does, other than the fact that he is raised from the grave. And so these seven are kind of placed. You've got these seven statements, I am, and these seven miracles. We know that John is the symbolism of seven. And it ties to the perfection and the completeness of what God did in the garden when he made the world. And John is recognized by the early church as without error, as the correct way of understanding the person of Jesus. So sometimes you might run into friends that say, well, there are other gospels out there. Why are you only listening to those four? Well, it's because the early church, who were closest to the events and the eyewitnesses, tested those early writings and determined that these four really give an accurate picture of Jesus. The other writings, for various reasons, had error or they did not provide for us a clear picture of Jesus. And it's so important for us to understand that, because John has a very planned reason, a very, very clear purpose for why he is writing. And so if you have your Bibles, you can turn with me. We're just going to look at a couple verses here as we close up. His purpose for writing is found in chapter 20, verse 30 to 31. He recognized that the disciples saw Jesus do many other miraculous signs in addition to the ones recorded here. So he recognizes there's more than these seven. But these were written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing in him, you would have life by the power of his name or through his name. I want you to underline those two phrases there. Believe that, and then by believing that you might have. See, this was the reason John wrote his gospel, so that people would believe in who Jesus Christ was. There were so many different stories about who Jesus was. And he is kind of, at the end of this era, is really trying to put a full and complete and definitive, this is all you need to know to really get the picture of who Jesus is. And then through that knowledge and through that trust to receive that he has for you life. In our day and age, sometimes people will write or develop a little gospel tract that they can give to somebody, because oftentimes there's a confusion about all the different things that the church teaches and what the Bible says and that sort of stuff. And sometimes we're trying to get the heart of it in a very clear way for somebody to understand. If you want to think about the Gospel of John, it is this passionate kind of writing of the last gospel in such a way that there's this is the complete and perfect stuff. This is all that you need to understand Jesus in his fullness and to receive all that you get. Doesn't mean that there isn't more that he's done, but if you would get John and what he's trying to get across, it would move us through that trust in him into a place of reality where we would really receive life like we have never had it before. And actually in John, he talks about, I came to have abundance. something that happened that I'd never seen before on the stage at Emma Luna, and I found a video of it, which I think is very important for us just to watch for a minute. It's not actually from the actual Cirque du Soleil. It's from another person doing a very similar thing. But it's the issue of how everything can be kept in balance by one small item. Watch with me. Thank you. share what God's doing